that away from the sensual world toward nibbana. Samsara, and the word samsara means compounded, cycles, means that which goes from birth to death, the endless cycles of habit. And so nibbana is the goal for the Buddhist. Away from the jungle, from the complexities of the sensual realms, to the peace of nibbana. Now this can be realized in this lifetime. It's not a goal that we have to wait for and then know when, only if it's real when we die. So the Buddha, Gautama the Buddha, was the one who realized nibbana, and he taught accordingly expedient methods, teachings that were conducive or helpful to human beings to also incline to nibbana, away from birth and death. The sensual world, and the senses, all your senses are all about birth and death. What you see, let's say the organ of the eye, your eyes. They're so dependent on so many factors, aren't they? And whether the light, whether it's day or night, whether your eyes are healthy or not so healthy, they can be easily destroyed. And yet we become very attached to what we see, don't we? Become very attached to colors and shapes and forms that we perceive with the eye. We identify as look at your own face in a mirror, and you identify with your face, don't you, what your face looks like. If you just saw your hand or your foot, or important organs like your heart or liver, with no kind of relationship to your face, you wouldn't even recognize them, would you, as being yours. The faces are what we're very attached to, aren't we? Faces of each other. What we feel secure with. Attached to the known and what is definite. The way things seem to be, we're very attached to the conventions, customs, and the appearance of things. The ear and the object, the sound. When we hear pleasant sounds, we seek to listen, to hold on to that which is pleasant to hear, or to turn away from unpleasant sounds. Smell, seeking the pleasure of fragrance, pleasant odors, or trying to get away from unpleasant ones. Taste, touch, and your body, just how much of our life is spent just trying to avoid pain, physical discomfort, seeking physical, sensual pleasure in the body, warmth, the delights of pleasant bodily sensations. And then thought itself. We can get a lot of pleasure from thinking, or a lot of misery. This is called a discriminative consciousness, consciousness through senses. So the sensual world is a compounded world of birth and death. And its very nature is dukkha, or dukkha in this Pali word it means imperfect, unsatisfactory. You'll never find perfect happiness, contentment, peace in the sensual world. It will always bring despair and death. The sensual world is unsatisfactory. So we only suffer from it when we expect it to satisfy us, don't we? We suffer from the sensual world, sensory experience, when we expect from it more than it can possibly give us, such as permanent security, happiness, permanent love and safety and pleasure, hoping that our life will be only one of pleasure and have no pain in it. If we could kind of get rid of all diseases, all sickness, conquer old age. Remember, like 20 years ago in the States, they had this great hope that modern science would be able to get rid of illnesses, get rid of mental illnesses. They thought all mental illnesses are due to chemical imbalances. We just find the right chemical combinations, inject them into the body, and all schizophrenics, paranoids, all these just snap out of it. We'll have a healthy society. No more headaches, no more backaches. We could replace all our internal organs eventually with nice plastic ones, and your heart wears out. I read an article about 10 years ago in an Australian medical journal about how they hope to conquer old age so they won't have to get old. As the world population increases, we keep having more children and nobody ever gets old and dies. I think what a mess that would be. The sensual world is unsatisfactory, and that's the way it's supposed to be. And when we attach to it, it takes us to despair, because attachment means that we want it to be satisfactory. We want it to satisfy us, to make us content and happy and secure. But just notice the nature of happiness. How long can you stay happy? And what is happiness? Well, things that make me happy when I get what I want. You give me something that I want, I'm happy. You say something that I like to hear and I feel happy. You do something that I approve of and I'm happy. The sun shines and I'm happy. You make nice food and serve it to me and I'm happy. So happiness is but how long can one stay happy? How can we depend always for the sun to shine? In England, the weather is very changeable. The happiness about the sun shining in England is obviously very impermanent and unsatisfactory. And then the unhappiness is what? Not getting what I want, wanting it to be sunny when it's cold and wet and rainy, people doing things that I don't like, that I don't approve of, having food that isn't delicious, that I don't like, I get unhappy. Life gets boring and tedious and I'm unhappy with it. So unhappiness and happiness are very dependent things on getting what you want or having to get what you don't want. And yet happiness is the pursuit of most people's lives, isn't it? The pursuit of happiness is my right. I think in the American Constitution they say the right to the pursuit of happiness. Getting what we want, what we think we deserve. And yet happiness always will take us to unhappiness, because how long can you really be happy? Does life just have to be perpetually getting what you want? And we have to arrange and control and manipulate all conditions so that we're always getting what we want, and we're always hearing what we want to hear, and we're always seeing what we want to see, so that we never have to experience unhappiness or despair. It's impossible, isn't it? So happiness is unsatisfactory in this way. You see what I mean? Its nature is unsatisfactory, it's dukkha. Happiness can never really, it is nothing to depend on, nothing to make the goal for your life. Happiness will always be disappointing because it lasts only so briefly, and then it's gone, and then there's unhappiness. And happiness is always dependent upon so many other things. Like we can be happy when we're healthy. Feel so vigorous, so wonderful. I'm so much bigger these days. I'm happy. And then one can lose that health very quickly. And our human bodies are subject to such sudden rapid changes. And then we're terribly unhappy because we've lost the health that we liked so much, all the vigor, the pleasure of feeling energetic and vigorous. So the goal for the Buddhist isn't happiness, not to seek happiness, because we recognize that happiness is unsatisfactory. The goal is away from the sensual world, not a rejection of it, but understanding the sensual world so well that we no longer seek it as an end in itself. We no longer expect the sensory world to satisfy us. We no longer demand that the sensory consciousness be anything other than an existing condition that we can skillfully use according to time and place. We no longer attach and cling to and demand from the senses that they always be pleasant, or feel despair and sorrow when the sensory impingement is unpleasant. So Nibbana isn't a kind of state of blank, a trance where you're just totally wiped out in the blank. Not nothingness or annihilationism. But it's like a space, going into the space of the mind, where you no longer attach, no longer are deluded by the appearance of things. You're no longer demanding from the sensual world anything other than recognizing it as it arises and passes. So the being born in the human condition means that we inevitably experience old age, sickness, death. One time, and our monastery in England, our woman, young mother, her baby had been ill for about a week, terrible kind of illness where it would just be coughing all the time, horrible kind of miserable coughs. And so she came to the monastery one Sunday. She looked totally depressed and miserable and holding the baby, and was sitting there in the reception room, and the baby started this terrible coughing, turned red in the face, started screaming and coughing. The mother said, "Oh, Venerable Sumedho, why does he have to suffer? Why does this sweet little baby have to suffer? He's never hurt anybody. He's never done anything wrong. Why? What in some previous life, what did he do that he has to suffer like this?" I said, "He was born, wasn't he? If he wasn't born, he wouldn't have to suffer." When we're born, we have to expect those things. Having a human body means that we are going to experience sickness, pain, despair, old age, death. Now, this is an important reflection. Because we can speculate about in the previous life, maybe he choked a bear to death or something like that. We get and he has to pay for it in this life. And that's mere speculation, and it doesn't really help. But what we can know is that being born, the karmic result of being born, like we all experience and have experienced, sickness and pain, hunger, thirst, the aging process of our bodies, and the inevitable death that awaits them. That's karma, isn't it? When we talk about the law of karma, what begins must end. What is born must die. The law of karma is we come to this house here, therefore we must separate from it eventually, don't we? What comes together must separate. We think, I don't want to separate from something I really like. Somebody I love, I don't want to ever separate. And yet the fact that coming together means inevitably separation. So we're not being pessimistic or morbid about the way things are, but we're just observing. So we don't expect life to be other than what it is. We can always cope with life and endure it and delight. When it's delightful, we can enjoy it, but we needn't be helpless victims of it if we understand it. How much misery there is in human existence because we expect life to be other. We have this romantic idea that maybe like Prince Charming in Cinderella. The little glass slipper fits on a pretty little foot. They get married, live happily ever after. That's a child's story, isn't it? Where we think we'll meet the right person, fall in love, made in heaven by God, and we'll live happily ever after. Never fight, we'll always have this kind of wonderful relationship, be perfect. But then what about death? Well, maybe we'll die at the same time. Hope, isn't it? Hope, and then the despair when the loved one dies before you do. Or runs away with the dustman and traveling salesman. Another incident was one time, like when you notice little children, you can learn a lot from observing small children because they don't disguise their feelings. They just express what they feel in the moment, usually. So when they're miserable, they start crying. When they're happy, they laugh. They haven't learned to cover it up. One time, I went to somebody's home. Their little girl, I went with the father of this little girl. She was very happy to see her father. So this happiness at meeting your father or someone you love. And then he said, well, I have to take Venerable Sumedho to, I was giving a talk that night at the Sussex University. I have to take Venerable Sumedho to Sussex University. And so he started walking out the door and the little girl started screaming. She turned red in the face. Screaming in anguish. And so the father said, it's all right, I'll be back in an hour. I'll be back, you needn't cry like that. But she wasn't developed to that level yet where she could understand, I'll be back in an hour. Just the immediacy of separating from that which you love was the immediate anguish. You know, she hadn't, if, you know, now we would say, if we're someone we love is leaving, we say, well, I'll come back and see you in a couple of hours. And, oh, that's all right, we wouldn't feel anguish. But a little child, say, two-year-old girl, immediately separation from the love brought in this anguish. And if you notice, just in life, how much of our life is a sense of that feeling of sorrow when we have to separate from someone we like or love, from having to leave a place that we really like to be in. Just note, and when you're really mindful, you can see the not wanting to separate, that sense of sorrow, which we can let go of immediately because we know that we can come back again, but it's still there. I just traveled around the world, past from November to March, always meeting, arriving in airport, somebody meeting me, hello, and then a few days later, goodbye. And then always the sense of come back, and then yes, I'll come back. So I've committed myself to do the same thing next year. We can't say goodbye forever, can we? To someone you like, yeah. Goodbye forever. I mean, in a friendly, you might say that when you're angry with them. I don't ever want to see you again, but you really don't mean that. So we say, oh, we'll meet again. We'll see, I'll phone you up. Write a letter. See you again. Until next time we meet. And all that. We have all these words that we can kind of cover over the sense of sorrow at separation. Now in meditation we're noting, just observing what sorrow really is. We're not saying that you shouldn't feel sorrowful when you separate from someone you love. It's natural, isn't it, to feel sorrow. But we're now, as meditators, beginning to witness that sorrow so we understand it, rather than just suppress, cover it over, pretend it's something more than what it is. Or just neglect it. Many people, like in England, people tend to suppress sorrow when somebody dies. They don't want to cry or have emotional kind of sorrow when somebody dies. So when they start meditating, suddenly they'll find themselves just crying over the death of somebody 15 years ago, that they didn't cry for when 15 years ago. They end up having to do it 15 years later. I think, I don't want to make a scene here at this funeral. Stiff upper lip. Stiff upper lip, I won't cry. So when somebody dies, somebody we love dies, sometimes we don't want to admit the sorrow or make a scene. We don't want to cry. Because we think maybe crying is weak or it's embarrassing for others. We don't want to upset people. So we tend to suppress and hold back things, not recognizing the nature of things as they really are, not recognizing our human predicament and learning from it. We're trying to live on a very, maybe very idealistic plane, according to very high-minded ideals. So we have to suppress the natural things of being a human being, suppress and repress them out of consciousness. But they catch up with us anyway, no matter what, in this lifetime or in the next. So in meditation, we're taking this time to open the mind, to allow the mind to open up, and allow the things that have been suppressed or repressed out of consciousness to appear, to become conscious. So, because when things become conscious, then they have a way of ceasing, rather than just being repressed again. Through consciousness, you allow things to take their course to cessation. You allow things to go away, rather than just push them away. Suppression is like just putting something over something else, pretending you don't see it, because like this clock here, suppression is, clock's gone, isn't it? I can't see it anymore. Where did it go? Gone. I never liked that clock anyway. Gone. Because I can't see it. No, suppression is like that. Putting something on top of something else so it looks like it's not there anymore. Pushing things away from us so that we just refuse to accept or recognize certain things. They're still around, but I'm angry with you, I just look over at Tundasiri. I don't recognize my anger or anything, I just have habits of whenever I feel upset or angry with anyone, bored or unpleasant feelings arise, I look to something, look at the beautiful flowers or the sky, read a book, watch television, do something. So I'm never really fully consciously bored or fully angry or fully, really not recognizing my despair, my disappointment. Because I can always run off into something else. I can always eat, go to the refrigerator, eat cakes and sweets, listen to stereo. The world now, we've perfected the sensory experiences to the kind of ultimate peaks of, I hear they have new kind of music equipment now, much better than discs and records and things like that. The sound with no kind of electronic noises to it. Or you can just sit there in your living room and listen to the most beautiful music. It's easy to absorb into music, isn't it? Away from boredom and despair into something that's very exciting or interesting or calming or beautiful. Look at how dependent we are on reading books or watching television. Everything's published now. They print everything in books. There's bookshops. Books are just like, now pretty soon now, I think have to burn them all. There's so many now. Useless books everywhere. Everybody writing something without having anything worth saying, usually. People writing their life history, these kind of tawdry and not very nice film stars write their biographies, make a lot of money. People read all the gossip, scandals. Because we get away from the boredom of our own existence, don't we? The discontentment with it, the tedium. By reading about the gossip of film stars, movie stars, public figures. Scandals and gossip and all that. We can entertain it because it's exciting news, isn't it? It's not like our lives, which can be quite tedious and boring. And we've never really accepted boredom as a conscious state. When as soon as boredom comes to the mind, we start looking for something interesting, something pleasant, So in meditation, we're allowing boredom to be fully bored, consciously bored. Depressed, fed up, jealous, angry, disgusted. All these things, all the kind of nasty, unpleasant experiences of life that we have repressed out of consciousness, have never really looked at, never accepted, we now begin to accept into consciousness. Not as a personality problem anymore, but just out of compassion, just out of kindness and wisdom, we allow things to take their natural course to cessation. Rather than just keeping things always on, keeping going around in the same cycles, the same dreary, monotonous cycles of habit. But then our lives are really dreary and hopeless when we have no way of letting things take their natural course. Because we're always controlling, we're always caught in some dreary, boring habit of mind in which we can't really appreciate beauty or the pleasure of the senses, because we've become jaded, depressed. We never really see, never really can recognize things as they really are. Remember one experience in my first year of meditation in Thailand. I went through the first year I spent very much by myself in a little hut. And the first few months were really terrible. And all kinds of things kept coming up in my mind. Obsessions and fears and terror and hatred. I never felt so much hatred. I'd never thought of myself as being one that hated people. But during those first few months of meditation, it seemed like I hated everybody. Couldn't think of anything nice about anyone anymore. Just so much aversion coming up into consciousness. And then one afternoon, after all a few months went by, I started having this kind of strange sign. I saw a kind of, I thought I was going crazy, actually. I saw people walking off my brain. Saw my mother kind of walk out of my brain and off into emptiness, disappeared in space. My father, my sister. I actually saw these like visions and walking out of my head. I'm crazy, I've gone off. But it wasn't an unpleasant feeling. Then the next morning I woke up and I looked around and I saw everything I saw was beautiful. Everything was, even the most unbeautiful detail was beautiful. I was in a state of awe. The hut itself was not a beautiful hut by anyone's standards. It was a crude, not very nice hut, actually. But it looked like a palace. It looked so beautiful. And the forest around it was kind of scrubby-looking trees. They all looked very, very beautiful. I went into the bathroom, which was not beautiful at all, and it looked beautiful. The sunbeams streaming through the windows of the bath into a plastic dish. And the plastic dish looked beautiful. And that sense of beauty seemed to stay with me for about a week. Just everything was extraordinarily beautiful. And then reflecting on it, I suddenly realized that that's the way things really are when your mind is clear. That I'd been, like, up to that time, I'd been looking through like a dirty window for so many years. Like you become so used to the scum and the dirt on the window, you don't think that it's dirty. You think that's the way it is. So you look, you get used to looking through a dirty window, and everything's dirty, isn't it? Gray and grimy, ugly. So then I cleaned the window through meditation, and suddenly I saw through a clean window again. I could see colors, light. It's like the mind had been cleaned, like I cleaned the window, washed the window, and all the scum and filth that had been accumulated onto that pane of glass had, was removed, and I could see clearly for the first time. So meditation is also, at first, for a way of cleaning the window, washing the window, purifying the mind, allowing things to come up into consciousness, letting things go. Then with the wisdom faculty, the Buddha wisdom, you're observing how things really are. So you're not just trying to, you're not just attaching to beauty or to purity of mind, but you're actually understanding, wisely reflecting on the way nature operates so that you no longer be deluded by it and create habits for your life around through ignorance. No longer through ignorance. So birth means old age, sickness, death. That's to do with your body. That's your body, isn't it? That's not you, though. Your human body is not really yours. So it's no longer, no matter what your particular appearance might be, whether you're in good health or not, whether you're beautiful or not beautiful, whether you're black or white, male or female, whatever, these are not self. And we mean by anatta that the human bodies belong to nature. They follow the laws of nature, meaning that they're born, they grow up, they get old and die. Now when you fully appreciate that, you might understand that, accept that rationally, but emotionally you're still, one tends to be very attached to the body. It's a very strong attachment. So in meditation we begin to see this attachment. We don't take a position that we shouldn't be attached, because that's starting from an ideal again. The problem with me is I'm attached to my body. Shouldn't be, should I? It's bad, isn't it? If I were a wise man, I wouldn't be attached to it. Like trying to start out at climbing the tree from the top. I should be at the top of the tree. I shouldn't be down here. So as much as we might recognize that we would like to be at the top, we have to humbly accept that we're not at the top yet, that we're at the, we have to first see where the trunk of the tree is, where the roots are. Look for the most ordinary, the gross, the coarse things first before we start identifying with anything at the top of the tree. Now this is a way of wise reflection. So it's not just kind of purifying the mind and then trying to just live in attached to ideas of purity, not trying to just refine consciousness so that you attain high states of consciousness that you can induce whenever you feel like it. Because even the most refined states of sensory consciousness are unsatisfactory. Like happiness, they're dependent on so many things. But Nibbana isn't dependent upon any conditions. Conditions can arise and pass away. Coarse, ugly, nasty, or beautiful, refined, whatever the quality might be, it doesn't interfere with nirvana, with the peace of your mind. So you're inclining away, not through aversion to the senses or the sensory world, because if you feel aversion to it, if you try to annihilate the senses, that in itself is a habit that you blindly acquire, trying to get rid of that which you don't like. That's why we have to be very patient. This lifetime as a human being is a lifetime of meditation, from now till the death of your body. See, that is a span of meditation. See that your lifespan is your meditation, rather than just 10-day retreat here. I meditated for 10 days. Didn't get enlightened. Thought I was enlightened several times, and somehow when I'm back home, don't feel enlightened anymore. I'd like to go back and take a longer retreat where I can feel more enlightened than I did the last time. If I get a higher state of consciousness, a more refined state of consciousness, that would be nice. But the more refined you go, the more coarse your daily life must be, isn't it? You get really high, and then you go back to the mundane routine of daily life in a city. It's even worse than before, isn't it? You've gone so high, then the ordinariness of life seems much more ordinary and gross and unpleasant. But the way through insight and wisdom is not making preferences for refinement over coarseness, but recognizing that refined consciousness, coarse consciousness, these are impermanent conditions, unsatisfactory, that nature is never will satisfy you, and that they're anatta, not self. They're not what you are, not yours. So the Buddha's teaching is a very simple teaching. And what could be more simple than what is born must die? That's some great new philosophical discovery, is it? Even illiterate tribal people know that. You don't have to study in universities to know that truth. When you don't contemplate your own death, then you think, when you're young, you think, I've got so many years of youth and happiness. And if you're beautiful and young, you think, I'm going to be beautiful and young for forever, seems like. And somebody says, when you're 20 years old, you're having a good time, life is wonderful, really wonderful and beautiful. And somebody says, you're going to die someday. Oh, what a depressing person that is. Let's not invite him again to our house. We don't want to think about that. We want to think about how wonderful life is, how much pleasure we can get out of it. And we can fill our days with just pleasure and beauty. But when you reflect on, wisely reflect on the fact that your body's going to die, growing old, death. This isn't being morbid or sick or depressing, but it's considering the whole cycle of existence. And when you know that cycle, then you are more careful about how you live. People do horrible things because they don't reflect on their death. They don't wisely reflect and consider. They just follow their passions, the feelings of the moment. trying to get pleasure and then feeling angry or depressed when life doesn't give us what we want. And this is a good opportunity here during this retreat, isn't it? This way of reflecting on life, your own life, and your death, the death of the body, the cycles of nature, just watching during this time, just observing how, what delights, what depresses, how we can feel very kind of negative or very positive. Notice how we want to attach to beauty or to the positive feelings or the inspiration. When we feel inspired, that's really nice, isn't it? That inspiration. You see, Buddhism is the greatest religion of them all. When I discovered the Buddha, I was so happy. It's a wonderful, wonderful discovery. And we read inspired books that inspire the mind. We get a little doubtful, a little bit depressed. We go and read some inspiring thing again and get high. And then after a while, all the inspiring words of religion, you can't stand anymore. You just can't abide to read another book on Buddhism, another inspiring book on Buddhism. You're fed up with being inspired. You can only read so much. And you can get high, but remember, getting high is an impermanent condition. It's like getting happy. You have to keep kind of doing the same thing. After you do something over and over, you no longer feel happy with it. How much sweets can you eat? And I mean, at first it makes you happy, and after a while it makes you sick, doesn't it? So depending on religious inspiration is not enough, is it? Not. You get fed up with Buddhism, then you go off and try something else, some new thing. We get inspired by the latest craze, the latest thing. Because we do, we attach to inspiration, to romance. You get tired of when the romance goes away from the relationship, then you start looking for someone else that you can feel romantic toward. I met a woman years ago in America. She'd been married 6 times, I think. She was only about 35. 7 times. And I said, you think you would have learned after the 3rd time or so? Why do you keep getting married? And she said, because I love that romance. The romantic side I like. The other side I don't like. At least she was honest. But not terribly wise, was she? So romance is a condition that conditions disillusionment. Romance, inspiration, excitement, adventure, all these things are the arising of something. And they go to a peak, and then that conditions their opposite, just like your inhalation conditions your exhalation. Think of just inhaling all the time. Like having one romance after another, isn't it? How long can you inhale? That's the inhalation conditions the exhalation. So that both are necessary, aren't they? One conditions the other. So birth conditions death. Hope conditions despair. One follows the other. Inspiration conditions disillusionment. So when you attach to hope, you're going to feel despair. When you attach to excitement, you're going to, it's going to take you to boredom. Attached to romance, it'll take you to disillusionment, to divorce. You attach to life and it takes you to death. So recognize that it's the attachment, isn't it? Attachment to these conditions. Meaning we expect them to be more than what they are. We want to be permanently inspired when on wise reflection we can see inspiration can only go so far, and then it stops. Then it conditions its opposite, disillusionment. So romance can only take you so far, and then it stops. If you're attached to romance, then you seem to feel bored or dissatisfied with the relationship when there's no more romance in it. If you attach to hoping for something, that attachment to hope takes you to the feeling of despair. So much of life for most people seems to be kind of hoping and waiting for something to happen, isn't it? It's the kind of expecting, anticipating, or maybe worrying or fearing that something unpleasant is going to happen. Some painful thing, some miserable thing is just waiting for you. Or maybe you're hoping that you'll be successful, somebody who you really love, or you have some great experience. Hoping, attachment to hope takes one to despair. So in this way we began to understand the things that create misery in our lives. That we are the actual creators of that misery. Because through our ignorance, through our not having widely understood the sensory world and its limitations, we identify with it. We seek our identity with all that is unsatisfactory and imperfect, that can only take us to despair and death anyway. So then, no wonder life is so depressing, isn't it? Dreary. Because of the attachment. We identify, we seek ourselves in all that is whose very nature is unsatisfactory, is dukkha, imperfect. Now when we stop doing that, when we let go, no longer attached, it means enlightenment, calling enlightened being, no longer attached, no longer identified, no longer deluded by the sensory world. We understand it. We know how to live with it, how to coexist with it, how to use it. We can use the sensory world for compassionate action, for joyous giving. We don't demand that the sensory world be here to satisfy me anymore. I don't demand that the sensory world be here to make me feel secure and safe or to give me anything. As soon as I expect the sensory world to satisfy me, it takes me to despair. But when I no longer identify with the sensory world as me and mine, anatta, the teaching of anatta, then I can enjoy the senses. But I no longer seek them, no longer depend on it, no longer expect them to be anything other than what they are. And when they change, one can endure. Patiently endure, peacefully endure the unpleasant side of existence. Sicknesses and pain and cold and hunger and failures, criticisms, things like this. One can endure that patiently, humbly enduring. So if you're not attached to the world, means you can adapt to change, whatever that change may be, whether it's for the better or for the worse. If you're still attached, then you can't adapt very well. You're always resisting, struggling, trying to control, manipulate everything. Then feeling frustrated and depressed or frightened because the world is such a kind of elusive, frightening place. You've never really contemplated it, never really taken time to understand it, know it. So it becomes a frightening, dangerous place for you, like the jungle. And the jungle's a frightening, dangerous place because we don't know what a jungle. Anything could be around the next tree, bush, cliff, wild animal, voracious man-eating tiger, terrible dragon, poisonous snake. The jungle is a very dangerous place. So nibbana, it means getting out of the jungle. Now when we move to nibbana, inclined to nibbana, we're moving to the peace of the mind. Now our mind is a peaceful place. The conditions may not be peaceful at all. Making a difference between the mind itself and the conditions of the mind. Conditions of the mind can be happy, miserable, elated, depressed, loving or hating, worried, fear-ridden, doubtful, bored. Those things come and go in the mind. But just like the space in this room. The space in this room has no quality to depress or elate us, does it? It's just as it is, space. And when you concentrate on space, when you look at the space in this room, you have to withdraw your attention from the things in the room. Now if I concentrate on the things in the room, I can become happy or unhappy. I see, oh, look at the beautiful Buddha Rupa. How lovely, and I become happy because I can see something beautiful. Or see something I find ugly, and oh, a terrible, disgusting thing. Or I can spend the time looking at the people, thinking whether I like you or don't like you. So my opinions about you, this way or that way. Remembering what you did in the past. Not being sure what you might do in the future. Seeing you as possible source of pain or of gratification to me. But if I withdraw my attention, that doesn't mean I have to push you all out of the room, do I? Get rid of the shrine. Means I just withdraw, I don't have to concentrate, absorb into any of the conditions, but into the space, and then I have a perspective. Because the space of this room has no quality to depress or elate. And the space can contain us all the conditions can come and go in this space. Now apply that to the mind itself, inwardly. Like moving, say going inward, inclining inward. The mind is like space, spacious. There's room for everything or nothing. The mind can be filled with everything or have nothing in it. Doesn't really matter. But you always have a perspective once you know the space of your mind, the emptiness of it, its spaciousness, so that things can come and go. Armies can come and go in the mind and leave. Butterflies or nothing. Rain clouds or whatever can go through, but you're no longer just caught in blind reactions, struggling, resistance, control and manipulation. So when we reside in the emptiness of our mind, we abide in emptiness, we're moving away, not getting rid of, but no longer absorbing into, blindly absorbing into the conditions that might exist in the mind at the present. We're not creating new conditions. So in our practice of letting go of identification with conditions, seeing that whatever it is, whether it's, if it's a happiness, whether it's a a misery, whatever it is, it's a condition. It comes, it goes, it's not self. This is what we mean by insight meditation, vipassana meditation. You're really looking at witnessing, listening, observing that whatever comes must go, coarse or refined, good or bad, and whatever comes and goes is not yours, is not what you are. You're not good, you're not bad, you're not male, female, beautiful or ugly. These are changing conditions in nature that are not self. Now this is a Buddhist way for enlightenment, going toward nirvana, inclining toward the spaciousness of mind, the emptiness, or the space of the mind, rather than being reborn and caught up into the conditions. Then you might ask a question, well then, if I'm not the conditions, if I'm not a man, if I'm not a woman, if I'm not this or that, then what am I? You want to know who you are, don't you? You'd like me to tell you. Do you want me to tell you who you are? Would you believe me if I did? If I do? Who am I, Venerable Tomato? What would you think of me if I start asking you who I am? Like trying to see your own eyes, you can't do it, can you? You can't know yourself because you are yourself. You can only know what is not yourself. So that solves all the problems, doesn't it? Just know what is not yourself, and then there's no question about who you are. If I said, who am I? And I said, I'm trying to find Venerable Tomato. I'm trying to find myself. And I start looking under the shrine, under the carpet, behind the curtain. You say, Tomato's really flipped out, hasn't he? He's gone crazy looking for himself. What a stupid thing to do. He doesn't have to look for himself. Nobody has to look for themselves. They're already there. I'm looking for me. Who am I? Where am I? It's the most ridiculous question in the world, isn't it? But the problem is not who we are, but the belief. Our belief, our identities with that which we're not. That's where the suffering is. That's where we feel misery and despair, depression. Is identity with everything that is not ourselves. So everything that is not ourself is unsatisfactory. It's dukkha, in other words. It's imperfect. So that when you identify with unsatisfactoriness, you're going to feel unsatisfactory, discontented. Obvious, isn't it? When you identify and cling to conditions, and all conditions are unsatisfactory, you're going to feel discontented and unsatisfied, dissatisfied with it. So the path of the Buddhist is the letting go rather than trying to find anything. The problem is the blind attachment, blind identification with the appearance of the sensory world. We needn't get rid of the sensory world, but learn from it, watch it, no longer allow ourselves to be deluded by it. Keep penetrating it with Buddha wisdom. Keep using this wisdom during this retreat so that you become more at ease with being wise rather than trying to make yourself become wise. And just by witnessing, observing, listening, being awake, aware, the wisdom will become clear. You'd be using wisdom in regards to your body, regards to your feelings, memories, thoughts, emotions, all these things, you see and witness, allow them to pass by, let them go. And during this retreat, as we have, as I was saying the other night, we have the ideal conditions. At least during this time, you don't have anything else to do with this, do you? Nothing else to do. No television, no books, nothing else to do but just be wise from one moment to the next.
Andamayang vada kata satukaran katamase satu satu.